on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Today's interview taking place literally in the middle of an oil field north of Bakersfield, California. Maybe we should call our guest today 90-year-old Walter Fees, the well whisperer, because from what I hear, his fellow employees at E&B Natural Resources in Bakersfield, guys like David Gifford, who introduced me to him, they say if there's a well that's having problems, they'll just take Mr. Fees out to it, and just from listening on the surface to what it's doing, he can diagnose exactly what's happening way down below. He never would have developed that expertise if he hadn't survived his paratrooper duty in World War II, and we're going to talk more about his first combat jump now. He'd already experienced combat in Italy, and he shared with us some of those gruesome moments when he lost close friends. But now it's August 15th, 1944. The Allies are invading southern France. Operation Dragoon is what we remember it as. But what do you remember about that first jump, going in behind enemy lines under the cover of darkness?
We went in at night. We loaded up about 5, 6 o'clock in the evening. We went across the Caspian Sea over by Nice, France, and then 15 miles into France. And there's two ridges there going this way. And they're like maybe 40, 50 miles across there. They were over 2,000 feet to go across these ridges. And then the planes were supposed to come in from the right like this and drop over and come down to 600 feet and jump us and then climb up and go out on the other side. But the Air Corps got scared, and when they come across those peaks, they just leveled off across there and jumped us more than 2,000 feet in the air. But before that, when we came in on the coast, man, that flak was something else. And I'm sitting there like this, and planes right over like this, about that far, and a big old piece of shrapnel comes through here, right out the other side. And I said, oh, Jesus, I want to get out of here.
So you're on a C-47?
C-47, yes, we had the one door.
So you're waiting in there to jump, and shrapnel comes within a foot or two of you?
Yeah, above my head here. I said, Jesus, I need to get out of here. And I could not wait. And I jumped, and I'm floating down through there, and I look down there, and there's the fog below us. And it looked like when they invaded Sicily, they had dumped two plane loads of paratroopers into the ocean. And so I looked down there and saw that fog, and so I grabbed my T5 pack. You got a T5 pack here, and you turn it, open it, and it drops. And then you just put your arms straight down like this and hold yourself in the chute. And then when you get within 15, 20 feet of the water, you throw your arms straight up, and the chute goes off that way, and you go straight down. Because if you go straight down with that chute, it'll take you under, and you never get up. So I'm all ready to do that, and all of a sudden I just sat down. I didn't even fall. I sat down in a plowed grape vineyard where it was all plowed up in the middle, you know. Yeah. I just sat down on it and never even fell down. And so that's the kind of luck I had.
So you're expecting a splash that never came, huh?
Splash never came. So then Bob Rock was there. Me and Bob Rock, we were both big guys. Bob Rock was 6'2". They put me and him in the back of the stick. You know what a stick is. It's 16 men, and you go out the door. And they put me and Bob Rock back there, and whenever that green light come on, we just started going forward and pushing just as hard as we could because we wanted to get out fast. And so Bob Rock was right in back of me, and I get to looking around for him. I holler at Bob, where are you? And I'm up here on the hill. He's on the hill, you know. And
this is in the middle of the night. It's all dark.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's 5 minutes to 5 in the morning when we jumped. So Bob Rock's hollering. We're hollering back and forth, and all of a sudden I hear shh, 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 going through the air, and I see these tracers going about 50 feet above us. And it's a German machine gun over there shooting at us, but he just didn't know what the hell he was doing. And so Bob come down off of there, and the side of his face was all bloody from hitting a tree and everything. And there, I hit that right in between the vineyard and never even fell down. So that's just the luck I had. I was lucky all the way.
And this is something that's always fascinated me with all the paratroopers I've spoken with, is jumping is nerve-wracking enough. Then you get on the ground. Yeah. And you got to figure out where in the world you are and where the enemy is.
Yeah, well, we had the compass. During training, they had taken us to Tennessee and dreamt us in the middle of Tennessee with nothing but our compasses on and a list of readings to go by. It was a 3-day trick to get to Cookeville, Tennessee. And we were back out in those mountains, so we learned in the States how to do that. We know we wanted to go south to go straight to the ocean to meet those Germans coming up. See, with 15 miles in, that's what they do with the paratroopers. You jump way back there, and you form your line and everything. Then the ships come on the shore in the morning at day of the bridge break and start pushing them back. And then when the Germans come back over that hill, there we were waiting for them. man about noon. That the big old cut over there, and a big old cut like this over there. Looked over there, and that highway was just solid with trucks coming, and looked like ants all over that hill where the Germans were coming. But just before that, Carl Salmon, our sniper, had went over there sniping them and everything. And about an hour later, the Jeep comes back with Carl laying on top of the hood with a bullet between his eyes. So, you know, just nothing, everything to shake you up. So here we look over there, and all them Germans are coming. And then we look up above us, and there's these funny-looking planes circling over us. See, there was 5,000 us, 5,000 British. These planes were circling over us, and so they're going to bomb us. Anyway, they circled over us, and here they went, over there bombing those Germans. And it was British Mosquito Light bomber they had. And there were six of them, and they just bombed the hell out of those guys over there. We're up on a hill covering a big grape vineyard, I mean like 2,000 acres or so. And all of a sudden, we looked out through there, and that whole grape vineyard was moving where the Germans were coming through it. And so we're laying up there. I'm popping my mortar right and left and everything. And then all of a sudden, vineyard just started disappearing from down at the other end all the way up through there. And it was the 442 up above us that Japanese American boys setting up there with their 4.2 mortars. And they just demolished that vineyard and all of them Germans in there. I went out through there, and there was over 200 of them dead in there. And it was those boys. So later on, whenever we left and went back, I go up through there, and there's the gliders that they came in on, and one of them was sitting like this up in the air, and there was 16 bodies laying under it with parachutes on them. Anybody got killed, you covered them with their parachute. There were 16 of them laying there under that edge of that glider. But the 442, boy, they were something else.
Well, and we've spoken to some of those 442nd Regimental Combat Team vets on this program, the guys whose families, for the most part, were in internment camps, and here they are risking their lives and, in many cases, giving their lives overseas. It sounds like you're saying that you're not sure you'd be here without the 442nd.
Oh, we wouldn't have been, because they had sneaked in back there in them gliders. See, I came in the first wave, which is one reason why I'm still here. It was dark, and we landed for anybody could even see us and everything. And then the third and fourth wave of the paratroopers coming in, they got hell shot out of them. And then the gliders came in with them. When they jump out, and the gliders are towing that back of them. They turn the gliders loose, and they come down. So they brought them 442 in by gliders. And I know they must have had high casualties, too. I got nothing but good to say about the 442. They're a fine group of young men, American men.
Amen. Well, and just hearing you describe all this, I can tell how real this all still is and how clear your memory is, and you're painting a powerful picture for the rest of us. So you'd been in Italy. Now here you are fighting the Germans in southern France, but you weren't quite done yet, huh?
No, we started back up through there, across the hills and into a valley over there, and I go down by this house, and I'm setting up my mortar there, and I look over across there about a mile, and there's a convoy of German trucks going up the other side of the river, up through that little town. So I set up my mortar and I started blasting hell out of them trucks. And I look up and here's six guys all dressed in black with armbands on, with dirty clothes on and everything, and carrying weapons on slings and everything, you know. And it was the Mach-E. They had been in there helping us, you know. And it was the Mach-E. They all came up and hugged us. That was nice.
Some people might not know what that means, what you're talking about.
Well, the Mach-E is the French resistance, and they were tough. They were tough boys. They hated the Germans so bad that it was far worse than we did, probably, because they had killed their women and everything, you know. They were just hugging us and everything. We give them grenades and all that kind of stuff.
So here you are. You're 20 years old. You fought your way through Italy and jumped behind enemy lines into southern France. And yet, now you look back and say, man, the Battle of the Bulge hadn't even happened yet, because you would be tested in that one, too. How did that unfold?
Down there in southern France, we turned to the right, went up these hills, these twisted roads that the trucks had to pull forward and back up, go around the turn and everything, up to the top of the Alps Maritimes, and we tangled with the Germans up there. One morning they took me down about 4 or 5 miles down this road and set me up on a little crossroads there and said, now there's about 50 Germans out there laying mines, and we got to stop them. And so my observer says, drop one in and go about 3,000 yards. So I dropped it in and went 3,000 yards. And he said, now bring it back about 150 yards and get it on this side. And then if they don't give up, you drop one in the middle. So I said, hell with this. I dropped it back 50 yards and dropped it in, and it was over. Killed three of them. The rest of them gave up, and they came up through there, and you would not believe that. They were ragged, dirty kids about anywhere from 17 to 19 years old, maybe even 16, in the German army, forced in there, and they had them out there. Man, they were crying and everything else. Scared the hell out of them. So, and then right after that, they brought us down off of that hill, and we got on the 40-8s and started towards Lille, France, for a 14-week vacation, which never materialized because of the Battle of the Bulge.
So you think you're going to get a much-deserved break after everything you've been through, and then they say, hey, we're running out of guys. We need more.
Yeah, they came in Tuesday of the second week and took all of our automatic weapons and mortars and everything and put them on trucks and sent them to the Battle of the Bulge to help those guys. See, those guys up there were getting the hell knocked out of them from them tanks. And so then next night, about 5 o'clock, they're loading us in. During the day, they brought in truckloads of stuff to replace our ammo and stuff. And 5 o'clock the next night, we're loading up in trucks and heading towards the Battle of the Bulge.
Merry Christmas, huh?
Yeah. Merry Christmas. We get up there, and we've traveled all night long and got out a truck and walked around towards the front. And there's a bush there, a dead German laying on top of it. And I said, here we are again. And they came to us and they said, well, there's a town up 5 miles up here. It's got 17 Germans in it. We want you to go up and run them out and occupy that town. So off we go. We run up there, and we run right into a regiment that had come in while there was just, that 17 was just the front echelon getting things ready for them. And so they were all set up there waiting on us when we got there. And they run us back to the town we jumped off from, and we were surrounded there for 9 days.
How many of you?
Well, Company C, 100 and whatever was left there, 80, 90 men by then, maybe.
So when you say surrounded for 9 days, maybe people say, oh, 9 days, that's not a long time. But if you're surrounded and you don't know if you're ever getting out, that sounds like an awful long time to me.
Well, when we come running back down that railroad track back to that town, we look out across there, and there's a big plateau out there. It's all rugged country, big deep thing with a river going down through it. And out on the other side is a big plateau, and out across there is 5 Tiger tanks coming. And I'm there at this first house, standing by the house, rigging up my mortar, and I hear that zipping again, you know. I look up in the air, and there's them tracers going by about 30 feet in the air. If they could have shot, if they were good shots, you know, a lot more of us would have been dead. But they were atrocious shots.
Not that you're complaining.
No, not complaining. So anyway, by the time they realized what was going on, we were gone. We were back in the house. And we looked up, and here come a bunch of P-38s. You know what a P-38 is, a double body deal. And they were circling over them tanks, and they started bombing all around there and missing them and everything. All of a sudden, the tank right in the middle just disappeared. You know, it just must have had all there was big old pieces of scrap iron around there. And so, and the mother four turned around and back out into the woods they go. Otherwise, we were going to really be in it. If they got out there up against that bank of that river shooting across at us, we'd have been in trouble.
Yeah, and I sense a pattern here. There are a lot of points where you guys were bailed out or rescued, whether it's the 442nd or those P-38 pilots. Oh, yeah. But tell me about, so this is December and January, and that coldest winter that's so infamous at the Bulge.
We were surrounded right through Christmas of 1944.
What were your living conditions? Did you have shelter?
I was inside a house. There's a story there. I was telling you about that .32 Beretta I carried. I was laying there, and you know me, I was under the table, under the kitchen table, sleeping. And they had come to us and told us, now, the Germans are sneaking in and talking in broken English, like wanting to know if you could come in and keep warm or get milk or something like that. In broken English, and then when you answered them, they shot you. So anyway, I'm laying there, and all of a sudden, I hear a door opening over there, and it says, please, milk for baby. And I said, oh, Jesus. So I just reached and got that .38 and reached around the leg of that table and busted one off, and I shot it right above his head. And he disappeared, and everybody, all my buddies laying around and jumped up and everything, what the hell's going on there? And they seen where I hit that facing there, and they went in there, and there was a well-concealed door, and this guy and his wife and his mother and 2 little kids, one of them was a baby, was down in that cellar there for days. We didn't even know about it. And it just scared him to death. Anyway, they went down there and got him and brought him back up, and I apologized and everything. But, you know, they did tell us that. They did tell us that the Germans were doing that. 2 of my buddies went out in the houses over there. There's a shack right at the back of the house, and the cows are in there. So they went out there with that guy and stood and guarded him while he milked the cow and got a bunch of milk. And the women came up and went through the kitchen getting all kinds of stuff and everything. And they just disappeared back through the door. We never saw them again. And a couple nights later, we got attacked coming down the hill. And there was hedgerows all up and down in between each alfalfa field. You know, like us, we have a bump, but they have a hedgerow. And then in between that, they're mowing the hay and stuff, you know. So down through there came these Germans all over the place. And one of our machine gunners was over there, machine gunning out the window and everything. And I look around this house here. Come a guy, stuff hanging all over him and clothes all over him. He comes around there and he looks up there at that machine gunner of ours and raises his gun. And I had a carbine at that time. And we all started firing at him. And he just raised his gun like that and then he just ran down over on his face. Our gunner looked out the window and looked down there and then looked over at us, waved, turned around, started shooting again. And our Lieutenant Allingham, he goes over there to lead a squad up there to finish cleaning up the Germans over there. And he's going up one side of the hedgerow, and a German sticks a gun through there and shoots him. And he fell right there, so that dang German reached through there and pulled a pin on his phosphorus hand grenade. We had all them hand grenades hanging on us, you know. And he pulled a pin on the phosphorus hand grenade, and Lieutenant Allingham was burning there way up in the night. And that's another terrible thing.
Yeah, I think we can all imagine how things like that can get seared into your memory and you can't unsee them. I want to ask you a little more about that incident in the home with the German civilians, but it's break time again. The rest of Walter Fee's World War II paratrooper story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.